From Fred, a thunderbolt. Having athlete's foot of the mind was how I felt. I vividly remember my internal struggles between the consequences of my sin and the pleasure of my sin. I remember when those consequences finally got to the point where they weren't worth the pleasure of the sin. But did I qualify as an addict? When I read one author's description of a four-step addiction cycle, preoccupation, ritualization, compulsive sexual behavior, and then despair, I knew I'd lived that pattern. I was certain that what I'd experienced and what these other men had experienced was addiction. But a thunderbolt hit me when the author outlined the three levels of addiction. Keep in mind that this wasn't a Christian book. Level 1. Contains behaviors that are regarded as normal, acceptable, or tolerable. Examples include masturbation, homosexuality, and prostitution. Level 2. Behaviors that are clearly victimizing and for which legal sanctions are enforced. These are generally seen as nuisance offenses, such as exhibitionism or voyeurism. Level 3. Behaviors that have grave consequences for the victims and legal consequences for the addicts, such as incest, child molestation, or rape. Did you listen to that list closely? Did you notice that the examples of level 1 include not just masturbation, which most men practice at times, but also homosexuality and prostitution? We would be willing to wager that the vast majority of men reading this book do not engage in homosexual acts or use prostitutes. By the definition above, maybe we aren't addicts after all. But if we aren't addicts, what are we? From Steve, Fractional Addiction. Before we answer that question, let's think again about those three levels of addiction as described above. From our Christian perspective, let's insert another level at the bottom of the addiction scale. If we categorize being totally pure and holy as the zero level, most Christian men we know would fall somewhere between level 0 and level 1. If you're one of the many men in this area, it probably isn't at all helpful to label you as an addict or to imply that victory will take years of therapy. Instead, victory can be measured in weeks, as we'll describe later. Your addictive behaviors are not rooted in some deep, dark, shadowy mental maze as they are in levels 1, 2, and 3. Rather, they're based on pleasure highs. Men receive a chemical high from sexually charged images. A hormone called epinephrine is secreted into the bloodstream, which locks into the memory whatever stimulus is present at the time of the emotional excitement. I've counseled men who became emotionally and sexually stimulated just from entertaining thoughts of sexual activity. A guy dead set on purchasing Hustler at his local 7-Eleven is sexually stimulated long before he even steps into the convenience store. His stimulation began in his thought process, which triggered his nervous system, which secreted epinephrine into the bloodstream. From my counseling experience, I believe it's often true that those men living at level 1 or worse have deep psychological problems that will take years to work through. But relatively few men live there. Our contention is that the vast majority of men stuck in sexual sin are living between level 0 and level 1. We can call this fractional addiction, since it represents living at a level that's a fraction between 0 and 1. When we're fractionally addicted, we surely experience addictive drawings, but we aren't compelled to act to solve some pain. We're compelled by the chemical high and the sexual gratification it brings. Another way of looking at the scope of the problem is to picture a bell curve. According to our experiences, we figure around 10% of men have no sexual temptation problem with their eyes and their minds. At the other end of the curve, we figure that there's another 10% of men who are sexual addicts and have a serious problem with lust. They've been so beaten and scarred by emotional events that they simply can't overcome that sin in their lives. They need more counseling and a transforming washing by the Word. The rest of us comprise the middle 80%, living in various shades of gray when it comes to sexual sin. Going for forbidden fruit. As I described earlier, I lived in this area of fractional addiction during my first decade of marriage, as well as earlier in my adolescence and college years. My interest in the female body had been formed when I was 4 and 5 years old and visiting my grandfather's machine shop in Ranger, Texas. I loved walking into that old shop filled with lathes and presses, where Grandpa made tools to retrieve broken oil well pipes. His office wall was adorned with nude pinups, and I stared at these voluptuous, naked women in awe. As I grew older, I saw women more as objects than people who had feelings. Pornography became for me an enticement to forbidden love. Many young women I dated in high school and college were sexually pure and stayed sexually pure while we dated, but I was always manipulating and conniving, going for what was forbidden. I later tasted the forbidden fruit when I entered the promiscuous period of my life. When I did have premarital sex, it gave me a sense of control and ownership, as if these young women belonged to me. They were objects of my gratification, just like those pictures on the wall in my grandfather's shop. Secrets. When I met Sandy, we made a commitment not to have sex before we married, and we didn't. I didn't tell her about my past, however, nor did I disclose all the secret compartments named past relationships or promiscuity. As a result, I dragged my past into our marriage, which produced problems just as she dragged her own set of problems into our marital union. Our marriage almost didn't survive the first few tumultuous years. The angrier I became at Sandy during those dark times, the more lustful my thoughts would be. I began living in a secret world of gratification that came from looking at other beautiful women, whether they were found in fashion magazines or women's magazines. Looking back, I see how those images broke the connection between us. But I was ignorant. Ignorant of the fact that I was hurting my marriage. After all, I wasn't having sex with anyone except her. I wasn't getting all over massages in seedy parts of town, or even masturbating to those photo spreads of barely clad models. But what I was doing was bringing something into the marriage that didn't need to be there. I felt entitled to have this secret world where I experienced small doses of gratification by looking up and down at well-built women. That hurt my marriage. What I, along with Fred, needed to do was train my eyes and mind to behave. I needed to align my eyes and mind with Scripture and to avoid every hint of sexual immorality. Before we get into an action plan for realigning your eyes and mind, however, we need to talk further about the roots of the sexual bondage. How is it that so many Christian men can't find their way out of sexual sin? We'll start exploring why in the next chapter. The heart of a woman. Male sexual impurity can be unsettling, even shocking to women, which is why we're including sections from interviews we conducted with women regarding every man's battle. Dina, when asked for her reaction to this book's premise, replied, "This stuff is crazy. Women don't have that problem." Fawn decided men and women are so different in their sexual wiring that it defies understanding. "I was surprised to learn," she said, "that Christian men have this problem even after they're married. I found the intensity of the problem to be shocking." Kathy said, "I did not know the depth that men would go and the risk they would take to satisfy their desires. I was unaware of how intense these temptations are and how much defense a man must muster to avoid stepping over God's boundaries." Andrea said that from talking with her father and the different guys she dated, she knows men are easily attracted visually, but she never realized the major extent of this problem until she met her future husband. "At the time, he was my closest friend in the youth group, but we were not romantically inclined," Andrea said. "He did feel safe enough with me to share his problem with pornography. It was quite a battle for him, as he had first been exposed to it in third grade. I was a little amazed by it all because, although I was attracted to guys by their looks during my dating years, the physical attraction I felt was nothing compared to what a man feels when looking at a woman." Brenda, Fred's wife, also participated in the interviews. she summarized the typical female response. I don't want to sound mean, but because women don't generally experience this problem, it seems to us that some men are uncontrolled perverts who don't think about anything but sex. It even affects my trust in men, knowing that pastors and deacons could have this problem. I don't like it that men lustfully take advantage of women in their thoughts, although I realize that women can be largely to blame because of what they wear. It's at least some comfort to know that many guys have this problem. Since most men are affected, we really can't call you guys perverts. Gee, thanks, Brenda. Actually, you made an important point, and it brings up additional thoughts from a man's perspective. We men understand your shock. After all, we're often overwhelmed in the sexual area, and we loathe it ourselves. That's why we want mercy, although we know we don't deserve mercy. How much mercy can be found in a woman's heart when she looks upon this problem? Not surprisingly, it depends on her husband's situation. There's a natural tug of war in the hearts of women between pity and disgust, between mercy and judgment. Ellen said, "After hearing about this, I was surprised that married men would have so much trouble. I feel very sorry for them. When I asked my own husband about it, he was honest with me that he had some struggles, and at first I was hurt. Then I just felt thankful that he would share with me. He hasn't had a major problem in this area, for which I'm thankful." Kathy leans toward mercy as well. "My husband is regularly bombarded with sexy images, and I was pleased with his honesty regarding that," she said. "I want to know the temptations he faces. It will only help me to be more sympathetic to his plight. I didn't feel betrayed because he's proven faithful in this battle. Other women are not so lucky." What about those women whose husbands have been losing big in the battle? "When my husband and I talked about this, he was honest," Dina conveyed, "and I was very angry with him. I was hurt. I felt deeply betrayed because I'd been dieting and working out to keep my weight down so that it would always look nice to him. I couldn't figure out why he still needed to look at other women." Women told us that they struggle between pity and anger, and their feelings may ebb and flow with the tide of their husband's battle. Let us direct this advice to women reading this book. Though you know you should pray for him and fulfill him sexually, sometimes you won't want to. Talk to each other openly and honestly. Then do the right thing. Part 2. How We Got Here. Chapter 4. Mixing Standards. For most of us, becoming ensnared by sexual sin happened easily and naturally, like slipping off an icy log. Why is that? As we'll see later, our maleness brings us a natural vulnerability to sexual sin. But for now, let's explore how the fickle human heart makes us vulnerable as well. Perhaps you've mustered the hope that you would someday be free from sexual sin and expected to grow out of it naturally as you grew into it, like outgrowing acne. Perhaps you waited with each birthday for your sexual impurity to clear up. It never did. Later, you assumed you'd be freed naturally through marriage. But, as for many of us, that didn't happen either. From Fred, Misplaced Confidence. When Mark signed up for my pre-marriage class, he told me, "The whole problem of impurity has been a mess. I've been hooked for years, and I'm counting on marriage to free me. I'll be able to have sex whenever I want it. Satan won't be able to tempt me at all." When we got together a few years later, I wasn't surprised to hear that marriage hadn't fixed the problem. "You know, Fred, my wife doesn't desire sex as often as I do," he said. "Oh, really? I don't want to seem like a sex addict or anything, but I probably have as many unmet desires now as I did before marriage. On top of all that, some areas of sexual exploration seem embarrassing or immodest to her. Sometimes she even calls them kinky. I think she's rather prudish, but what do I say? In our experience, not much. Marriage, no sexual nirvana." That marriage doesn't eliminate sexual impurity comes as no surprise to married men, although it does for teens and young singles. Ron, a youth pastor in Minnesota, said that when he challenges young men to be sexually pure, their response is, "That's easy for you to say, Pastor. You're married. You can have sex anytime you want." Young singles believe that marriage creates a state of sexual nirvana. If only it were so. First of all, sex has different meanings to men and women. Men primarily receive intimacy just before and during intercourse. Women gain intimacy through touching, sharing, hugging, and communication. Is it any wonder that the frequency of sex is less important to women than to men, as Mark Wolfley discovered? Because of the differences between men and women, forming a satisfying sex life in marriage is hardly a slam dunk. It's more like making a half-court shot. Second, life throws hard curves. Lance married his sweetheart only to find that his wife had a structural deficiency that made intercourse very painful. It took surgery and months of rehabilitation to correct the problem. For Bill, his wife once became so ill that he couldn't have intercourse for 8 months. Did these circumstances free Lance and Bill to say, "God, I'll just keep using pornography until you heal my wife"? We don't think so. Third, your wife may suddenly become much different from the woman you courted. Larry, a strapping, handsome young pastor in Washington, D.C., has a great Christian heritage. His father is a wonderful pastor, and Larry was thrilled when God also called him into the ministry. When Larry met Linda, a striking blonde bombshell, they appeared meant for each other, a regular Ken and Barbie set. After their wedding day, however, Larry found Linda to be far more interested in her career than in fulfilling him sexually. Not only was she disinterested in sex, she often used it as a manipulative weapon to get her own way. Consequently, Larry doesn't have sex very often. Twice a month is a bonanza, and once every 2 months is the norm. What's Larry supposed to say to God? "Lord, Linda is being ungodly. Change her, and then I'll stop masturbating." Hardly. Marriage didn't satisfy Larry's sexual needs, but God still expects purity. Your purity must not depend upon your mate's health or desire. God holds you responsible, and if you don't gain control before your wedding day, you can expect it to crop up after the honeymoon. If you're single and watching sensual R-rated movies, wedded bliss won't change this habit. If your eyes lock on passing babes, they'll still roam after you say, "I do." You're masturbating now? Putting that ring on your finger won't keep your hands off yourself. What's going on here? When marriage doesn't immediately solve our problem, we cling to the hope that, given enough time, marriage may yet free us. Andy told us, "I once read that a man's sex drive drops in his 30s and 40s, while a woman's sex drive reaches its peak during that time. For a while, I thought that Jill and I would meet in some blissful middle ground. It didn't happen." But freedom from sexual sin rarely comes through marriage or the passage of time. The phrase "dirty old man" should tell us something about that. So if you're tired of sexual impurity and of the mediocre, distant relationship with God that results from it, quit waiting for marriage or some hormone drop to save the day. If you want to change, recognize that you're impure because you've diluted God's standard of sexual purity with your own. That's the first of three reasons we'll look at for how easily men fall into sexual sin. We've said earlier that God's standard is that we avoid every hint of sexual immorality in our lives. If we followed this standard, we would never see sexual bondage. So we should be amazed that so many Christian men are under that bondage. Our Heavenly Father is amazed. Here's our paraphrase of some questions God asked in Hosea chapter 8, verses 5 and 6, that reveal His amazement. "What is going on here? Why are my children choosing to be impure? They are Christians, for heaven's sake. When are they going to start acting like it?" God knows that we're Christians and that we can choose to be pure. So why don't we? We aren't victims of some vast conspiracy to ensnare us sexually. We've simply chosen to mix in our own standards of sexual conduct with God's standard. Since we found God's standard too difficult, we created a mixture, something new, something comfortable, something mediocre. What do we mean by mixture? Perhaps a good example is the muddled definition of sexual relations that surfaced in the sex scandal involving President Bill Clinton. After the president stated under oath that he did not have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, he later explained that he didn't view oral sex as being in that category. So by that definition, he hadn't committed adultery. That represents quite a contrast to the standard that Christ taught. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. Naive, rebellious, careless. Why do we so easily mix in our own standards with God's? Why are we so soft in our choices regarding sexual sin? Sometimes we're simply naive. Do you remember seeing the animated Disney classic Pinocchio when you were growing up? Pinocchio knew it was the right thing for all little boys to go to school. On his way there, however, he met some scoundrels who painted a wonderful picture of spending the day at a place called Adventure Island, a sort of amusement park just offshore. They gave Pinocchio a free ticket on the ferry over, but he didn't know that at day's end, all the boys would be turned into donkeys and be sold to pull carts in the coal mines for the rest of their lives. Likewise, we can be naive and foolish regarding God's standard for sexual purity, as we stumble blindly into wrong because everyone else is doing it. But sometimes we choose wrong sexual standards not because we're naive, but simply because we're rebellious. We're like Lampwick, a swaggering boy who takes the lead in diverting Pinocchio to Adventure Island. Lampwick comes across as distasteful from the moment he appears on the screen with his macho posturing, spitting, and sneering little voice. You ask yourself, where are his parents? Why don't they do something? You know he's fully aware of the evil he's doing. Whatever the aftermath, he richly deserves it. Perhaps with a rebelliousness like Lampwick's, you know sexual immorality is wrong, but you do it anyway. You love your trips to Adventure Island despite the hidden price you pay at the end of the day. Or maybe you've considered God's standard too ridiculous to take seriously. In one singles Bible study group, the discussion turned to sexual purity. Many had been married before and were struggling with loneliness. When someone suggested that God expects even singles to avoid every hint of sexual immorality, one attractive young woman blurted out, "Nobody could possibly expect us to live that way." Except for two who defended God's standard. Destruction and loathing. Whether you've been naive, rebellious, or foolishly negligent in taking God's standard seriously, mixing in your own standards leads to being ensnared and even worse. Mixture can destroy a people. When the Israelites left Egypt and were led to the Promised Land, God told them to cross the Jordan River and destroy every evil thing in their new homeland. That meant killing all the heathen people and crushing their gods to powder. God warned them that if they failed to do this, their culture would mix with the pagans, and they would adopt their depraved practices. But the Israelites were not careful to destroy everything. They found it easier and easier to stop short. In time, the things and people left undestroyed became a snare. The Israelites became adulterous in their relationship to God and repeatedly turned their backs on Him. As promised, He removed them from their land. But just before the destruction of Jerusalem and the final deportation of her inhabitants, God prophesied this about His people in their coming captivity. "Then in the nations where they have been carried captive, those who escape will remember me, how I have been grieved by their adulterous hearts which have turned away from me, and by their eyes which have lusted after their idols. They will loathe themselves for the evil they have done." Ezekiel chapter 6, verse 9. When we entered the promised land of our salvation, we were told to eliminate every hint of sexual immorality in our lives. Since entering that land, have you failed to crush sexual sin, every hint of it? If not, have you come to the point of loathing yourself for that failure? If that's where you are, there's hope for you. God's standard from the Bible. Because our own standards on sexual purity have been so mixed with God's, and since many Christians don't read their Bibles very often, many men have no clue about God's standard for sexual purity. Did you know that we're commanded to avoid sexual impurity in nearly every book of the New Testament? The following is a selection of passages that teach God's concern for our sexual purity. But I, Jesus, tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. For from within, out of men's heart, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. Mark chapter 7, verses 21 through 23. You are to abstain from sexual immorality. Acts chapter 15, verse 29. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Romans chapter 13, verses 12 and 13. I am writing you that you must not associate with anyone who calls himself a brother, but is sexually immoral or greedy, an idolater or a slanderer, a drunkard or a swindler. With such a man do not even eat. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 11. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13. Flee from sexual immorality. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18. I am afraid that when I come again, I will be grieved over many who have sinned earlier and have not repented of the impurity, sexual sin, and debauchery in which they have indulged. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 21. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. The acts of the sinful nature are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity, and debauchery. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16 and 19. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality, or of any kind of impurity, or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. Nor should there be obscenity, foolish talk, or coarse joking, which are out of place. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these the wrath of God is coming. Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God. For God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 3 through 5 and 7. See that no one is sexually immoral. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16. Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. Jude chapter 7. Nevertheless, I, Jesus, have a few things against you. You have people there who hold to the teachings of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin by committing sexual immorality. Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. Nevertheless, I, Jesus, have this against you. You tolerate that woman Jezebel who calls herself a prophetess. By her teaching, she misleads my servants into sexual immorality. Revelation chapter 2, verse 20. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Revelation chapter 21, verse 8. Isn't that something? More than half of the books in the New Testament are represented here. Drawing from these passages, let's summarize God's standard for sexual purity. First, sexual immorality begins with the lustful attitudes of our sinful natures. It is rooted in the darkness within us. Therefore, sexual immorality, like other sins that enslave unbelievers, will incur God's wrath. Second, our bodies were not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, who has both created us and called us to live in sexual purity. His will is that every Christian be sexually pure in his thoughts and his words, as well as in his actions. Third, therefore it is holy and honorable to completely avoid sexual immorality, to repent of it, to flee from it, and to put it to death in our lives, as we live by the Spirit. We've spent enough time living like pagans in passionate lust. Fourth, we should not be in close association with another Christian who persists in sexual immorality. And fifth, if you entice others to sexual immorality, maybe in the back seat or back room, Jesus himself has something against you. Clearly, God does expect us to live according to his standard. In fact, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3, the Bible flatly states that this is God's will. So take his command seriously. Flee sexual immorality. Chapter 5, Obedience or Mere Excellence. Why do we find it so easy to mix our standards of sexual sin and so difficult to firmly commit to true purity? Because we're used to it. We easily tolerate mixed standards of sexual purity because we tolerate mixed standards in most other areas of our lives. Excellence or obedience? Question: what's your aim in life? Excellence or obedience? What's the difference? To aim for obedience is to aim for perfection, not for excellence, which is actually something less. Wait a minute, you reply. I thought excellence and perfection were the same thing. Sometimes they appear to be, but mere excellence allows room for a mixture. In most arenas, excellence is not a fixed standard at all. It's a mixed standard. Let us show you what we mean. American businesses are in search of excellence. They could be in search of perfection, of course. Perfect products, perfect service. But perfection is too costly and eats into profits. Rather than be perfect, businesses know it's enough to seem perfect to their customers. By stopping short of perfection, they find a profitable balance between quality and costs. To find this balance, they often look to their peers to discover the best practices of their industry. How far can we go and still seem perfect? By how far can we stop short? Businesses find it profitable to stop short at the middle ground of excellence because perfection costs too much. But is it profitable for Christians to stop short at the middle ground of excellence where costs are low, balanced somewhere between paganism and obedience? Not at all. While in business it's profitable to seem perfect, in the spiritual realm, it's merely comfortable to seem perfect. It is never profitable. Clearly, excellence isn't the same as obedience or perfection. The search for excellence leaves us overwhelmingly vulnerable to snare after snare, since it allows room for mixture. The search for obedience or perfection does not. Excellence is a mixed standard, while obedience is a fixed standard. We want to shoot for the fixed standard. From Fred, asking the wrong question. I was the perfect example of someone who wasn't shooting for God's mixed standard of obedience. I was teaching classes at church, chairing activities groups, and attending discipleship classes. My church attendance was exemplary, and I spoke the Christian language. Like the businessman seeking the best business practices, I was asking myself, how far can I go and still be called a Christian? The question I should have been asking was, how holy can I be? Let me demonstrate the difference between excellence and obedience through a couple of stories from my pre-marriage class. When each 7-week session begins, I ask the students what they desire in marriage. During a recent class, all 6 couples declared that they wanted to build their relationships upon God's principles. Then I asked this question. Is it all right to modify the truth to avoid unpleasantness in the home? Each answered no, unanimously agreeing that modifying the truth was lying, and none of them would do that in their homes. Really? I asked. Then what about this? Brenda has had 4 children, and through the years, her weight has slid between 4 different wardrobe sizes. Much laughter usually follows this comment. During transitions between sizes, she often hoped to wear something from the smaller size wardrobe to church. Squeezing into it, she'd ask me, "Is this too tight?" She wanted to know whether the dress fit and whether it would draw attention to her weight. Often it was a close call, and I would have to choose between modifying the truth or hurting her feelings and discouraging her. Was it okay for me to modify the truth to avoid this unpleasantness? It's a small thing, after all, and I love her. If I told the truth, it would hurt her feelings, and I don't like to hurt her feelings. What would you do? Would you modify the truth? Amazingly, only moments after declaring that they would never modify the truth in their home, 5 out of the 6 couples now said they would indeed modify the truth to avoid this particular unpleasantness. They can speak the Christian language, and they certainly sound excellent, but can they live Christian truth? With excellence, we try to cover our disobedient tracks. Pete and Mary attended my pre-marriage class, and Pete impressed me from day one. He lapped up anything I said, nodding in assent at even the most difficult teachings regarding the husband's responsibilities, such as servanthood. At the end of the 7th week, Pete and Mary stopped me after class. "Your discussion on sexual purity really hit home last week," Pete began, "especially when you said that viewing pornography and X-rated movies won't strengthen your sex life. My first wife used to rent X-rated movies for me, and we would watch them together before going to bed. In the end, it hurt us." Then he added, "Mary and I will not do this in our marriage." So far, so good. But Mary, stepping in, said, "We've been having an ongoing struggle over what we watch together. We'll often rent a movie to watch at my apartment, but you know how it is. Most of the popular movies have some pretty racy scenes, and I'm feeling more and more uncomfortable with this. When it gets steamy, I tell Pete we need to turn it off. But he gets angry, arguing that we've invested good money in the rental and it's a waste of money to shut it off. So I go off into the kitchen to do some work while he finishes watching." She got a tear in her eye and looked down. "I don't feel these movies are good for us," she said. "I've asked him to stop for my sake, but he won't. We make it a practice to pray together before he goes home, but after these movies I often feel dirty and cheap. I feel these movies are coming between us." Of course, Pete was embarrassed. Was he in search of excellence or obedience? At least in this area, he had stopped short. By the standards of his peers, he knew he could watch popular movies with racy sexual situations and still seem Christian. That's all he needed. To his credit, Pete asked me what he should do. I told him to follow Mary's lead and not watch the sexy videos, and he agreed to do so. Together on the middle ground. So often there's no challenging voice like Mary's calling us to obedience and perfection. Satisfied with mere excellence, we stop short of God's standards. We move nearer our peers only to find distance from God. Even banded together in congregations, we stop short. Our event-driven approach in our churches feels good, but often fails to really challenge us. My church in Des Moines has an excellent choir known throughout our region for its professional sound. Our orchestra is even supplemented by players from the local professional symphony orchestra. In discussing our church with a new neighbor, she said, "Oh, I've been to your church. I really like it. It's like going to a show." My church has an excellent schedule of tradition-driven events. There's our Super Bowl Sunday evening service that fosters racial harmony. We have Honor America Night every 4th of July to honor our great country, inviting renowned speakers like Elizabeth Dole, Gary Bauer, and Cal Thomas. Our annual Metro Night honors the volunteers and staff of our daughter church in the inner city. We have Christmas specials, Easter specials, Friends Day, Back to School Night, and much more. Clearly, we're striving to be the church to belong to in Des Moines. Have we profited? What has come from this search for excellence? Recently, we scheduled a week of nightly all-church prayer meetings to begin the new year. Now, hardly anyone would argue with the strategic value of prayer or question the fact that we're commanded as believers to be faithful at it. But obedience in the matter of prayer is costly and takes commitment. On Monday night, as our week of prayer began, a mere 34 adults showed up out of a regular church attendance of 2,300. By Thursday, only 17 adults were praying. I was totally discouraged. Yet 1 week later, on Worker Recognition Sunday, 1,000 people were there to be recognized for their service in the church. I also organized an intercessors group during our church's Wednesday night services, simply opening a room for 90 minutes of intercession for our congregation. The first night, a half dozen people came to the door and asked, "Is this the room where they're teaching about intercession?" "No, we won't be teaching about intercession," I answered. "We're going to be interceding." Each person turned away to leave. It feels good to learn about intercession, but it's a costly thing to do. The same can be said about purity. What can we expect? In so many areas, we're often sitting together on the middle ground of excellence, a good distance from God. When challenged by His higher standards, we're comforted that we don't look too different from these around us. Trouble is, we don't look much different from non-Christians either. Our adolescent Christians are often indistinguishable from their non-Christian peers, sharing the same activities, music, jokes, and attitudes about premarital sex. Kristen, a teenager, told us, "Our youth group is filled with kids faking their Christian walk. They are actually taking drugs, drinking, partying, and having sex. If you want to walk purely, it's easier to hang around with the non-Christians at school than to hang around with the Christians at church. I say that because school friends know where I stand, and they say, 'That's cool, I can accept that.' The Christian kids mock me, laughing and asking, 'Why be so straight? Get a life.' They pressure my values at every turn." She told us about Brad, a lay leader's son, who told her, "I know intercourse is wrong before marriage, but anything short of that is fine. I love to get up under a bra." Sadly, the adults are no different from the Christian teens. Linda, a single career woman, says her adult singles group at church has players, men and women who stalk their prey to satisfy their own needs. Christian couples have also fallen short. From Steve, "My daily radio show is filled with calls from Christians asking how they can recover from adulterous affairs or deal with a marital separation." Have we gone blind? What can we expect from our across-the-board commitment to the middle ground? Don't we realize that our recent converts to Christianity will become just like us? Will it be a comfort to see them as lazy regarding their personal devotion to Jesus as we are? And don't we realize what our slack standards are costing us in our witness to the world? In Revival Praying, author Leonard Ravenhill writes, "This present day is like an arena whose terraces are filled with the militant godless, the brilliant and belligerent skeptics, plus the blank-faced heathen millions, all looking into the empty ring to see what the Church of the Living God can do. How I burn at this point. What are we Christians doing? To use a very tattered phrase, are we just playing church? The right response. Israel's King Josiah was only 26 years of age when he faced a similar situation of neglect for God's standards. In 2 Chronicles 34, we read how a copy of God's law, long forgotten, had been found during a large-scale renovation of the temple. Then he listened as this law was read aloud to him, bringing inescapably to his attention God's standards and the people's failure to live up to them. Josiah didn't say, "Oh, come on, we've lived this way for years. Let's not get legalistic about all this." No, he was horrified. He tore his robes as a sign of grief and despair. "Great is the Lord's anger," he said, as he immediately acknowledged his people's negligence and sought God's further guidance. God quickly answered with these words about Josiah's reaction. "Because your heart was responsive and you humbled yourself before God when you heard what he spoke against this place and its people, and because you humbled yourself before me and tore your robes and wept in my presence, I have heard you," declares the Lord. Chapter 34, verse 27. At this point, notice how Josiah immediately led the entire nation in a thorough return to obedience to God's standards. Then the king went up to the temple of the Lord with the men of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, the priests and the Levites, all the people from the least to the greatest. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant which had been found in the temple of the Lord. The king stood by his pillar and renewed the covenant in the presence of the Lord. To follow the Lord and keep his commands, regulations and decrees with all his heart and all his soul, and to obey the words of the covenant written in this book. Then he had everyone in Jerusalem and Benjamin pledge themselves to it. The people of Jerusalem did this in accordance with the covenant of God, the God of their fathers. Josiah removed all the detestable idols from all the territory belonging to the Israelites, and he had all who were present in Israel serve the Lord their God. As long as he lived, they did not fail to follow the Lord, the God of their fathers. 2 Chronicles chapter 34, verses 29 through 33. No mixture there. Knowing that God's standard is the standard of true life, Josiah rose up and tore down everything that was in opposition to God. Counting the cost. And what about you? Now that you've heard about God's standard of sexual purity, are you willing in the spirit of Josiah to make a covenant to hold to that standard with all your heart and soul? Will you tear down every sexual thing that stands in opposition to God? Can you see that you've been living the mixed standards of mere excellence, stopping short but still looking Christian enough? Or have you aimed for obedience and perfection where you're truly called to go? How will you know? By the costs you're willing to pay. What's your Christian life costing you? It costs something to learn about Christ. It costs a lot to live like Christ. First, it costs something to join a few thousand men at a conference to sing praises to God and learn how we should live. It costs a lot to come home and remain committed to the changes you said you'd make in your life. Second, it costs something to avoid Playboy magazine. It costs a lot to control your eyes and mind daily. Third, it costs something to send your children to Christian school so others can teach your children about God. It costs a lot to have regular family devotions complete with dad leading worship songs and heartfelt prayer. And fourth, it costs something to insist that your kids dress modestly. It costs a lot to make them think modestly and nicely. So where do you stand? Are you comfortable? Do you have a broad tolerance of sin in your behavior? Has your approach to God led to a high level of mixture in your life? If so, you likely have mixture in your sexual standards, and you likely have at least a hint of sexual impurity in your life. You won't pay the price of true obedience, like avoiding the sensuality found in many Hollywood films, like avoiding thoughts of old girlfriends and the flirtatious woman at work, like training your eyes to look away from string bikinis, full-busted sweaters, slick spandex, and the women who wear them. God is your Father, and He expects obedience. Having given you the Holy Spirit as your power source, He believes His command should be enough for you, just as you believe your command should be enough for your kids. Trouble is, we aren't in search of obedience. We're in search of mere excellence, and His command is not enough. We push back, responding, "Why should I eliminate every hint? That's too hard." We have countless churches filled with countless men encumbered by sexual sin, weakened by low-grade sexual fevers. Men happy enough to go to Promise Keepers, but too sickly to be Promise Keepers. A spiritual battle for purity is going on in every heart and soul. The costs are real. Obedience is hard, requiring humility and meekness. Very rare elements indeed. We were told about James, a respected teen in his youth group who refused to promise to stay sexually pure when pressed to do so. "There are too many unforeseen situations out there for me to make such a promise," he said. James has stopped short. Have you? From Fred, "Who are you, really?" Sexual impurity has become rampant in the church because we've ignored the costly work of obedience to God's standards as individuals, asking too often, "How far can I go and still be called a Christian?" We've crafted an image and may even seem sexually pure, while permitting our eyes to play freely when no one is around, avoiding the hard work of being sexually pure. From my college days, one man's example of this still serves as a warning to me. During my freshman year at Stanford, I became homesick. A dorm buddy who grew up in the shadow of the university felt sorry for me and asked me to his parents' home for dinner. They were extremely wealthy and their home was stunning. What a great night! Not only did I have my first artichokes, which fascinate me to this day, but the mother was a strikingly pleasant host. And I learned that the father, a prominent local businessman, had a high position in their church and believed in the importance of family time. A few weeks later, I was sitting in a barber's chair when my friend's dad walked into the shop. Being somewhat shy, I didn't say anything, and because of my wet hair and the barber's drape around my neck, he didn't recognize me. Sitting down to wait his turn, he picked up a Playboy magazine. I was stunned. I watched to see whether he was just reading the articles, but he immediately turned to the centerfold, which he turned sideways to catch in its full glory. Is this you? Is there a secret dark side to your Christian image? If you're a teen, are you going on missions trips during the summer, but still fondling some girl's breasts in the back seat of a car? If you're a husband, are you teaching Sunday school and being active in a men's group, but fantasizing day and night about naked women? Who are you really? A search for mere excellence is an inadequate approach to God, leaving us vulnerable to snare after snare. Our only hope is obedience. If we don't kill every hint of immorality, we'll be captured by our tendency as males to draw sexual gratification and chemical highs through our eyes. We'll discuss this in detail in the next chapter. But we can't deal with our maleness until we first reject our right to mixed standards. As we ask, "How holy can I be?" we must pray and commit to a new relationship with God, fully aligned with His call to obedience. Chapter 6. Just by being male. Even apart from our stopping short of God's standards, we find another reason for the prevalence of sexual sin among men. We got there naturally, simply by being male. From Fred, our very maleness. Before I knew that my wife Brenda was pregnant with our fourth child, I became convinced through prayer that our future child would be a boy and our second son. I was so convinced of this that during Brenda's pregnancy, I told this to her and to a few close friends. As delivery day neared, the pressure rose. "Why did I tell everyone?" I whined. "What if it's a girl? What if I'm wrong?" With the start of Brenda's labor pains, the pressure on me seemed to double every minute. Finally, standing under the bright lights of the delivery room and watching a little head crowning toward birth, I knew the moment of truth was near. The baby came out face up. Good, I thought, I'll have a perfect view. Anxious, I gently urged Brenda. Come on, sweetheart, push a little more. The shoulders emerged, just a few more inches, I thought, and then... Oh, doctor, what are you doing? He turned the baby toward himself at the last moment, just as the hips and legs popped out. Now I could only see the baby's back. Come on, come on, I cried out inside. The doctor and nurse maddeningly said nothing. Methodically and efficiently, they dried the baby, suctioned the throat, and slapped a silly little cap on the newborn. When the doctor finally presented our new child to me, the legs were flopping apart. Immediately looking down, I just had to know. It's a boy, I exclaimed. Michael is now 8 years old, and his older brother Jason is 16, and I can assure you they definitely are both males. As I raise them, I'm aware of the natural tendencies inherent to maleness that will touch every aspect of sexual purity for them, just as they do for me. Our very maleness, and four male tendencies in particular, represents the third reason for the pervasiveness of sexual impurity among men. Males are rebellious by nature. When Paul explained to Timothy that Adam was not the one deceived, it was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 14, he was noting that Adam wasn't being tricked when he ate of the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. Adam knew it was wrong, but he ate it anyway. In the millennia since then, all of Adam's sons tend to be just as rebellious. Author George Gilder in Sexual Suicide reported that men commit more than 90% of major crimes of violence, 100% of the rapes, and 95% of the burglaries. Men comprise 94% of our drunken drivers, 70% of suicides, 91% of offenders against family and children. Most often, the chief perpetrators are single men. Our maleness brings a natural, uniquely male form of rebelliousness. This natural tendency gives us the arrogance needed to stop short of God's standards. As men, we'll often choose sin simply because we like our own way. Males find the straight life dull and boring. Dr. James Dobson summed up the straight life well in his book, Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives. The straight life for a working man is pulling your tired frame out of bed 5 days a week, 50 weeks out of the year. It is earning a 2-week vacation in August and choosing a trip that will please the kids. The straight life is spending your money wisely when you'd rather indulge in a new whatever. It is taking your son bike riding on Saturday when you want so